And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. I'm really glad to be your host for this edition. And, of course, you can always get in contact with either myself or Dr. Kamai at naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com, that's drznaturally.com, and suggest programs or check out our calendar of fun shops and various trips to, like, Jamaica and some of our webinars that we're doing, and get all updated with our calendar. So I'm really glad again to be here with one of my good friends and real pillars of naturopathic medicine, Dr. George Savastio. And George is a naturopathic doctor. He's one of the first graduates of the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine, where he started the Student Government Association. Then he went on to graduate, and he taught naturopathic philosophy at the university for a stint, then moved up to New Hampshire and worked with the late Dr. James D'Adamo Sr., whose son, of course, Peter D'Adamo, is well known as the blood type doctor. And, of course, then George learned a lot about Ayurvedic medicine and now combines all these different modalities and thoughts and things like that in his private practice in New Hampshire. He'll tell you more about that in a bit. But without further ado, hey, George, how are you?
Hey, good, Dr. Z. How are you today?
Oh, I'm having a smashing day. And so I'm really glad that we're able to, connect and do this program, because we were so happy to have you come down and lecture on philosophy during our philosophy day at the College of Naturopathic Medicine at the University of Bridgeport, because, you know, philosophy is, although some people feel that it's kind of an easy A in college, it really is extremely important, and most people don't think it's extremely important in medicine, but you're going to tell us otherwise, I'm sure, on the program here.
Yes.
So now, where are you practicing now?
Well, we recently moved to Rochester, New Hampshire, which is in that little strip of seacoast as you're passing through from Massachusetts up to Maine. We're in that little area near Portsmouth,
beautiful.
New Hampshire.
Wow,
yeah,
Rochester,
so, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, so we just bought a place here.
And you practice with your wife, Dr.
We
Beth
do
Devlin?
Practice together. Yes, we do practice together, which we've been doing now for the last 5 years, and we find it really works well for us.
It's great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into our topic there.
Sure.
George, folks, many people don't know that doctors have philosophies.
Yeah, unfortunately, many doctors don't know they have a philosophy. You know, when we think of philosophy, we think of, like, eggheads in an ivory tower, you know, going over minutiae, you know, if that doesn't matter to anyone but each other. But, you know, the fact is that we all live according to a philosophy, and most of us aren't aware that it is a philosophy. We think of our philosophy as the truth, and then people who have other philosophies are people who live in falsehood, you know, and they're wrong and we're right, and so forth. So to me, it's really important to realize what your philosophy is, where it came from, and then decide whether you like it or not, you know. Because you even see the world through the philosophy you have. You know, your philosophy might be very simple. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. And if that's your philosophy, then everywhere you go, you're going to see people competing, and that they just, it's, you know, they'll do anything to win, and that's all life is all about, and so forth. So it can really color your entire experience of being alive.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
So why does it matter to know philosophy besides that, especially in medicine?
Yes, absolutely. So a medical doctor, for example, usually would not think of himself or herself as even having a philosophy. They think, well, I'm a scientist, and I do scientific medicine, and there's no philosophy in science. Science has transcended philosophy and has found a way to find something that they call the objective world and so forth. So to really understand what a philosophy is, you really have to kind of go back to the real basics. So I always like to start with, well, how do you even know you're alive? How do people listening to this show know they're listening to it? Because they experience it. So everything that tells you you're alive is simply an experience. Vision, seeing is an experience. Hearing is an experience. Feeling is an experience. Tasting, smelling, all of those things are just experiences. And even your thoughts and your feelings, how do you know you're having a thought? You hear it. That's an experience. How do you know you're having a feeling? Because you feel it. That's an experience. So there is nothing in life that is not or outside of experience, because everything you know, even your knowledge, your stuff you learn from books, reading the book was an experience, having the teacher was an experience. So all there really is experience. So if we agree there, we're not really in a philosophy yet, because we're just acknowledging that our lives are just a flow of experience. Mm. Now, the minute we start to explain experience, now we've moved away from being in the moment and experiencing wherever you are, and now you're starting to explain it. That's a philosophy. Your explanations for experience, why this experience happened, what your experience means, all of that is philosophy. So, and this is where it gets tricky, and this is very hard for people to understand, again, because we think our philosophies are just the truth. But even the idea that there is an objective world that is out there, and that there's a separate me that is in here, those are concepts. That's actually a philosophy. So if we ask all of our listeners, you know, who thinks that the world was here before you were born, every single person would raise their hand. If you asked an enlightened person, was there a world here before you were born, that person would not raise his hand. So even believing in an objective world is not a truth. It's simply the philosophy of the day. So I want to dwell on this a little bit, because I know this is hard. And I've given this lecture, you know, in different variations and in informal conversations. And I see a lot of perplexed looks and furrowed brows, you know, when I start to talk about this.
Sure.
And yeah, because it's just, you know, well, of course the world is there. Yeah. Now, if we want to compare, now you, of course, have contact with the shamanistic culture.
Yeah.
And if we were to go to, you know, the plains of the United States a couple hundred years ago and talk to the, you know, the natives that were dwelling there at that point, they didn't really have, you know, the same sort of an idea that there's an objective world out there. And there are really, if you think about it, there's two major realms of experience. There's what we call reality, which is being awake and being conscious, and so that we have what we think of as the objective world in while we're awake. And then we go to a sleep, and we're in another realm where there's also an earth, and there are cars, and there's buildings, there's people, there's a sun, there's a moon, there's a sky. But that is a dream world. You know, so we make a big distinction between the waking world, which we call reality, and the dream world, which is just a dream. Now, in some shamanistic cultures, they don't make that distinction. When you wake up into this world, which follows its specific set of laws and rules, and it has a certain predictability to it. And then you go to sleep, and then you're simply in another world that is every bit equal and to this one. It's not just a dream. if you're moving from, you could say, you know, if you want to put it in our terms, you're dreaming when you're awake and you're dreaming when you're asleep. And then, of course, the shamans in the culture have access to more worlds. You know, they have, and of course, depending on the shamanistic tradition, they have an above world, above this one, and a below world. And they can travel between all of these different realms at will. So they don't single one of them out as being different than the other ones, except that the rules are a little bit different. And so, you know, the idea that this is reality and those are dreams is not something that is universal by any means. It's actually a fairly new idea in the course of human history. And and it's also, interestingly enough, you can't prove it. So many philosophers over time have looked into this question, and how would you prove that there's a world, you know, that existed before you, because and is independent of you? And you can't prove it because all of the proofs are experiences. So the
photos and pictures,
books,
and photos, things like that of the past are just experiences.
Those, they seem to point to something, but could you have a dream where you were interested in the past and somebody started showing you photos and books? Of course you could. So that, there's just no proof. And I'm going to jump around, of course, and not stick to our little script that we wrote out ahead of time.
Sure, you're okay with that. Yeah.
But the idea that there's an objective world very definitely has an origin. You know, that has not something, and it was dreamed up, I'm going to say, use that word intentionally, to solve the riddle of why people have such different experiences when they appear to be at the same event. So you have five witnesses, and you ask them independently what they saw at a particular event, and you're going to get five different stories. So all of us are familiar with that, and what we chalk it up to is, yes, there was an objective event, but everybody is subjective, and they see things through their own distorted filter, and so you're getting five distorted versions of quote-unquote reality. So that is an explanation. So you're explaining the fact that people have different experiences by assuming that, yes, there is an objective.
Dr. Sebastian.
Yes, please continue. I hope we're on tape.
Yes, we are.
Oh, good. Okay. So what was the last thing you heard? Because I didn't realize that we had lost our connection there.
Oh, okay. Well, we were talking about science and interpretation of science. And yeah.
And I was just getting into, in the 20th century, people recognize that, yes, science is also a philosophy. So there's a whole branch of philosophy called the, philosophy of science, and there are now college courses in it and so forth. And they recognized in the 20th century a lot of the things that I'm saying, and these are not my original thoughts. Much of this has come to me through readings and discussions and so forth. So in the 20th century, there was the recognition came that one, that there very well may not be an objective world. The objective world is simply an idea, and if all ideas come from the subjective mind, which is always false, then the idea of the objective world, by definition, is also false. So does that make sense?
Yeah, and I guess it ties in with quantum look at the universe as well,
absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. Once the quantum world opened up, the old world of mechanistic thinking really got put in the spotlight and didn't hold up very well. And along with that, the entire idea of an objective world viewed subjectively and therefore falsely really did come into view very squarely in the 20th century. And particle physics played a huge role in that.
Mm-hmm.
In 1927, Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein had a famous debate. You know, they gathered all the great physicists of the world to Copenhagen. And the subject of the debate is there an objective world? So,
wow.
And as far back as then, Albert Einstein was, you know, for all of his far-reaching brilliance and insight, really clung to the idea that, yes, there is an objective world out there. It is out there. It's independent of us. But, you know, he compared it to a watch that you can't open. So you'll never know what the objective world is as the interior of the watch that causes the hands to move, but you know it's there. And Niels Bohr, who is equally brilliant and well-known to physics students in any case, he argued that the mind can only see its own ideas, and we have no idea if there's a world out there or not. So within science, that revolution really came, and philosophy has, of course, moved along with that.
And then Heidelberg's uncertainty principle plays
a
role in that too.
Yeah, you can go on and on. Yeah, then
right.
Yeah, things acting at a distance. The whole mechanical universe fell apart at its very source, which is, you know, physics used to be considered the basis for all of the sciences. And as I said to the students, you know, in the 20th century, the biology, which had just started to gain a little footing for itself with Darwinism and having a mechanism for evolution, saw all of that kind of slip away, and they very consciously decided, we're not going to be that way. You know, we're going to stick to our 17th century principles that the world is, there is a separate universe, and it's basically mechanical. And
so tie this into holism, George,
yes,
and eventually medicine and what we're doing as naturopathic physicians.
Right. So, you know, this is, you know, what I kind of like to get at, and I hope to really define some of this so that people,
yeah,
and especially students, can understand it a little bit better. So the type of, you know, mechanistic science that I was just describing, you know, basically, we all know that. You know, the idea is that the world is objective. And our type of science is called reductionism. So we theorize about a theoretical objective world by doing experiments. And part of that, so this is all the philosophy of science. And part of that philosophy is that events that happen in the world that we can see, what we could say the macro world, are due to actually events that occur in the microscopic and submicroscopic world, and that the only true reality is the atoms that make up the universe and the forces that act on them. So without realizing it, you know, when naturopathic students come into naturopathic college, they already have that philosophy. The college has that philosophy. The teachers have that philosophy. Nobody even recognizes that that is a philosophy, that that's a belief system, and that is not a fact.
Right.
And so,
science, the way we learned it in class, to, you know, pre-med, is a philosophy.
It's a belief system, absolutely. So
we thought it was objective facts. You know, we thought these were facts, and you know.
Right. Right. So this is really. And that world disappeared. You know, and the physicists had a heck of a time trying to come to terms with it. And that's why they all gathered in Copenhagen. You know, they're trying to, like, what the heck is going on? We don't recognize anything anymore. We have to start over. So, you know, they, fortunately, there's a handful of, you know, the brilliant particle physicists. They kept going with it. But the rest of the, you know, biology didn't want to go along, and our culture has not gone along.
Right.
Which I think is a catastrophe in a way, because this mechanistic way is not helping us. You know, if we think of the world as a giant Darwinistic dog-eat-dog competition, competing for scarce resources, that's not working out real well for us right now. You know, that leads to war and famine and hoarding and all the other things that we see. So, holism actually is where particle physics, once you leave that behind, now you can start to see, well, what else is out there? So, holism is a whole other ballgame. So I started this discussion saying that all there is, all you ever know, is experience. And holism accepts that that's how it is. So experience is not subjective in holism. Experience is all there is. There's only experience. And so we can be scientific and explore experience and categorize our exploration and our observations and be very precise in our thinking and our observations. So apply some of the same rigor that we are used to seeing in science, but using an entirely different way of understanding it. So it's really the polar opposite of reductionism, which says that the whole is caused by the parts. Holism starts from the fact that, one, there's the universe is one. So that uni of universe means that it's one whole. The one whole that unites us all is experience itself. You are experience, I'm experience. You know me as an experience, I know you as an experience. And as I was alluding to, and this again is super hard for people, even my sense of being me as a distinct individual is an experience. I experience thoughts. Do you think thoughts or do you experience them? When you pay attention to this, you realize we don't have any control over our thoughts. We think of them as our thoughts, but they just appear just the way a cloud appears.
They just appear in the quantum.
Yeah.
Just like objects, things appear and disappear in the uncertainty.
Yes, and thoughts are just the same way. So I know you get this.
Yeah.
So this is holism. So those thoughts are not you. There's an experience of a thought. The feeling isn't you. There's an experience of a feeling. The body isn't you. There's a body there because you feel it. You can look at it. You can touch it, and so forth. But that. The people who understand holism to the ultimate, which is again enlightenment, the Buddha state of consciousness, they no longer identify as a person anymore.
Right.
They identify as experience, and the body that you think of as the Buddha's body or the enlightened person's body, they don't consider to be their own body at that point.
Right.
So that's holism taken to the extreme. Now, most of us aren't going to become enlightened, not in this lifetime in any case.
Right.
But can we practice a science and a medicine that is informed by that insight that the universe is one and that it is a whole and that all of the parts of it are expressions of the whole rather than independent separate objects? In that famous book about Chinese medicine, The Web That Has No Weaver, there in holism, you don't speculate about who did the weaving, but you see that there is a web here and that everything is connected in it. There's no such thing as something separate from it that could look out at the web and be not of the web. So there is, in that way, no independent subjective you. And so in holism as a science, it's, as I see it, it's like being awake in a dream, and we get to explore that dream. So you can look anywhere that you want, any phenomena that draws your interest, and then there, if you're a holistic scientist, you're going to put your entire attention and focus on whatever that phenomena or that happening is, and then you can learn about it not through theorizing about it. Your hypothesis in the science that we're familiar with is, of course, a subjective idea, and you impose it onto the whatever it is you're studying, and you follow, you know, you're trying to prove or disprove your hypothesis, and prove is really the wrong word, demonstrate that it fits or doesn't fit is more accurate. In holistic science, you're not doing that. You know, and this is, again, much more like what our native ancestors would do. So if they wanted to understand a plant, they didn't come up with a theory of the plant. You'd go and you would sit. And you would let, because the plant is an experience and your experience, there's no separation. You know, and again, I know these are hard concepts for people. But you just sit and you let the object or the phenomena reveal itself gradually to you. And that is the basis of Chinese medicine. That's the basis of Ayurveda. You know,
I was thinking that Chen Nong, he tried the plants too, and he experienced what they did with him, you know, and he wrote about it quite extensively.
Yeah. Exactly. So it, you know, in a way, it's his own experiment. But first, you look at it, you smell it, you touch it, you taste it. If you feel it's safe to taste, and you get to know all the different parts very intimately. In Ayurveda, they have the rishis, you know, who are considered the founders, you know, the ones who developed all of the knowledge. Rishi means seer. You know, so in ancient time, you know, you've heard Maharishi, great seer. You know,
seer.
Yeah. So the rishis were the individuals who, through contemplation, discovered all of the medicines in their environment, and they looked at everything, and they did it in just that way. They took their time. They would meditate, get into a very sort of, you know, a neutral state so that their bodies were neither hot nor cold or, you know, anything going on. And then if they wanted to know a food, you know, look at it, taste it, touch it. What's the texture? You know, what are the qualities of it? Ayurveda has 23 pairs of gunas. And in holism, everything you know is always in relationship to something else. You know, that's the basic yin and yang of existence. I know high because I know low. I know hot because I know cold.
Right.
There's no fixed absolutes. It's everything is in a relative state. So the rishis of Ayurveda would contemplate, meditate, then they're going to taste the food. Does it make me hotter or colder? You know, and they're going to sit for hours and see what it did. And so they were the experiment, and the experiment was simply an experience. And you might have other guides, you know, other rishis, you know, you would talk it over and discuss and so forth. So they had a method and a very scientific, very sober, you know, no fantasies, but based on experience. So if you could leave one thing with, you know, the naturopathic students out there and interested listeners in this, holism is based on experience. So the understanding is experience is real. That's all there is.
In homeopathy, Dr. Sebastio,
yes, absolutely.
We see that, you know, when these different remedies were given to patients by, of course, Hahnemann and many of his disciples and followers, they chronicled the cumulative experiences of thousands and thousands of people.
Yes, so that's a brilliant example. Absolutely, that's their method. And Hahnemann was very, you know, he understood there's no way to theorize what's going on in the body. We don't understand it. We can't understand it, but we can explore our experience of it and explore our experience of what the remedies do. So he was very much in that vein, to be sure.
So, you know,
let's take a quick break. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break just to announce the station.
Okay.
And then when we come back, we're going to talk about some of these other concepts, like the, you know, maybe the doctrine of the vital force or individualism, maybe suppression, maybe how did some of the other naturopaths or naturopathic minds take this holism and kind of filter it through their own experience and where we end up with our principles and some of these other, what I call aphorisms or distinctly concepts and terms, which, you know, have been meditated on over time. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Dr. Great. George Sevastio on the philosophy of medicine and holism. Stay tuned.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamprone, your host. And online with us is Dr. George Sevastio, who works at Elemental Medicine in New Hampshire. And we're really excited that he's talking about naturopathic philosophy, critical thinking, and medicine. Do you have a philosophy? And a lot of very interesting topics. Welcome back, Dr. Sevastio.
Thank you, Dr. Z.
Sure. Now, did you want to finish up holism? I wanted to talk about like how the forefathers of naturopathic medicine developed the catechism of what they call nature cure, and a lot of these ideas of like that Linlar and Luce and many of the four parents of naturopathic medicine took some of these ideas that you're talking about, like, is there a vital force?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an organizing force that what is health? What is disease? What is suppression? So maybe you can comment on some of those things, obstacles to cure. You like a lot of those concepts.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about those.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and they, of course, didn't think of themselves as philosophers, you know, first and foremost. They were simply, you know, observing. Many of the early pioneers of our movement were not medically trained. And so in one way, I think that really helped them because they weren't bogged down, you know, mentally with a lot of baggage that would have forced their thinking in a particular direction. And, you know, if we're left to ourselves, you know, when children come into the world, they get to know the world through experience. And they're fascinated by experience. You know, kids want to experience everything. They're picking up every rock and so forth. So that tendency, you know, that's in us. And that's an inborn, you know, you could say the default setting, I suppose, in our modern terminology. So the people who really opened up this path for us, you know, as naturopaths, I just think that they, you know, naturally were, you know, looked and saw, okay, you live a certain way, you end up getting sick. You live another way, you end up staying healthy. And that, you know, those kinds of very simple, obvious experiences made a deep impression, and then they could formulate that over time into, you know, what I would, you know, I think of naturopathic philosophy as the beginning of a philosophy. It never really had a chance to fully mature. And, you know, nowadays it seems to be getting abandoned,
yeah.
And which I think is a real shame. But I think if we bring in this holistic understanding, you know, and maybe even a little bit of in a formal sense, we can, you know, revive that and bring that back into being. So, you know, the biggest thing is in holism, it's the person who is sick. You know, you don't focus on the disease. So they have that. And that's true of Chinese medicine, Ayurveda. There's a lot of commonality between those two, and naturopathy in its original form is, and to me, a rudimentary version of Ayurveda and Chinese medicine. You know, the same kind of thought process without...
They did say that there were laws that people,
yes.
If they violated those laws, George,
yeah.
They would
yes.
get sick. So I guess, yes. like, there's laws of physics and
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They may
be... And that thinking is absolutely right. And all, you know, every culture has looked at the world and, you know, tribal cultures made it their business to find out what the laws, if they may not have used that word, maybe they called it something else, but that, you know, how do you stay healthy? We
yeah.
have a pretty rough life out here. What are we going to, you know... So that impulse goes back again to our roots as human beings. And if you, you know, whether you think of this as reality or a dream, it is consistent and it is lawful. You know, if I drop my keys a million times, they're going to fall to the earth a million times. So that much you could, you know, you can begin to formulate laws and without getting away from experience. And the laws are based on experience rather than theories. And so they recognize, you know, okay, in their terms, you know, these guys, most of them were very Christian and very, you know, like that kind of Calvinistic thinking, I think, you know, kind of gets in there, which unfortunately turns off modern readers and so forth. They tend to, you know, like if you sinners are eating, you know, meat and pie,
right, exactly.
and that kind of
yeah.
stuff. So it has a, you know, unfort that to me is a distraction in there.
Right.
But yes, yeah. the recognition that, you know, health is lawful, and yeah, and I did think all of these concepts are deepened in Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, and I would love to see naturopathy be a sort of our Western oriented version of those.
Mm.
So they. It would hold up on a par with both of them.
What about the idea of the accumulation of wastes and morbid matter and poisons
yeah.
and how those types of things can lead
yeah.
to...
Yeah. Now, again, those ideas go back to the dawn of time. You know, naturopaths didn't
yeah.
have to invent any of that. You know, you remember, you know, those old papyrus sheets and things from thousands of years ago talking about enemas and, you know, purging. And Ayurveda in particular is very cleansing oriented. And so, you know, certainly the idea is if you live in a way that, whatever way you want to say it, they would say that you break the laws. In Ayurveda, you might say you're getting out of harmony with the whole. You're eating because of not what your body wants, but because of what your emotions or your habits and so forth want.
Right.
And your digestion isn't very good. You know, the recognition that, you know, that toxins would be forming and accumulating in the body is an ancient one. And of course, we know, and the reason that idea has lasted for thousands of years is when you get rid of the toxins, the person does better. You know, you can, it's a major step in helping and even healing people. So, again, you know, if you stick with experience as your guide and you do cleansing and you see the benefits and you do it on yourself and you see the benefits, there's no doubt. If you're buried under theory, you can be a medical doctor and say, well, that doesn't do any good, you know, that your liver cleanses already, you know.
Yeah.
You have those kinds of ideas, you know, like as if the liver had no capacity and no limit. It could just clean no matter what you did.
Yeah,
foolishness.
Well, that's kind of the philosophy of the flu shot. It's like you get the flu shot and then you could still live and violate nature and think that you're going to not get sick.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, so they have a, you know, their philosophy, unfortunately, is because they don't even know they have it, they haven't refined it, and it's all very one-sided, foolish, short-sighted. You know, it is not a sound philosophy, and it doesn't hold up when you look at it. But if, you know, again, people see their philosophies, so it's very important to realize if you're, you know, a medical doctor and you've learned it that way, that's what you see, and you learn that everything else is voodoo, then that's what you're going to see. And if somebody gets cured, it was because of a spontaneous remission. It wasn't, you know, you're
still
correct.
But what about the difference between chronic disease and acute disease? Because, you know, you're saying disease is an experience. So if you may look it up in the Merck manual, and the patient has rheumatoid arthritis and certain lab tests,
mm-hmm.
say that they have rheumatoid arthritis, but their experience is going to be very different in how that manifests.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the theory of, like, individuality, or, you know, each patient differs in their susceptibilities, idiosyncrasies, and responses to the remedies, even if the exogenous cause is, quote-unquote, the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's another great point. So what we do is we start to scramble to come up with theories to cover it. And so there are, you know, there's a multitude of theories. If you stick to the original insight that the illness is an experience, then an experience is unlimited. You know, it's not bound by our concepts. And so the experience will vary, so we may put the same label on that experience because it, you know, shares certain characteristics with, other people's condition. But that's, you know, that's us labeling, and so we're getting away from experience and moving into theorizing at that point. So to
me,
we also noticed that
if we practice naturopathic medicine in an allopathic frame, maybe you could comment on what that means.
Right.
We don't see the same result. We see, in other words, you know, this is the person who applies, you know, rigid protocols to
mm-hmm.
every patient expecting the same outcome.
Yes. All right. So if you have the allopathic philosophy, of course, that patient is basically a mechanism. So this doesn't get thought through enough by people. So if you're a doctor, or if you're looking at underlying mechanisms, that means the patient is essentially a mechanism. First and foremost, that body is a machine, a very complicated one, and so forth. And then you're just looking for the malfunction and what biochemical or electrochemical process has, you know, gone awry for whatever reasons machines break down in life, and then you're trying to fix that, you know, then that, you know, there's so much wrapped up in that philosophy. Part of it is, if you think, you know, the person is the machine and my job is to be an objective analyzer of that machine, what's my relationship with that patient like? You know, that the patient's illness is an experience. You, as the doctor, are also an experience, and your remedies are experiences. So there's, you know, again, there's nothing outside of this. So for me, you know, at this stage, with a holistic outlook, I recognize my role as an experience for that person. And what my goal in the interaction is, one, I'm going to be loving and compassionate. That person is an experience, and experience is me. There's nothing outside of me in this. I know this is hard stuff for people, but that's, when you take it all the way, that's how it is. So, ultimately, I want to create that loving, compassionate environment. So then I'm setting a stage. And I want to break down that person's expectations about what the limits of his healing are going to be. Well, the doctor said I have a 90% chance of getting a relapse in 2 years of my cancer, something like that. So much of what the doctor does limits a patient's experience, limits it to imagined probabilities and statistics and so forth. So you're having what Deepak Chopra called the nocebo effect in some cases, where your doctoring is actually helping to make the patient worse, or at least flounder. So, for me, it's all about setting the stage for healing. And healing is an experience. I don't know what its limits are. I never want to impose my personal ideas on it to limit it. So we don't know what's going to happen. Let's try. Let's go for it. And in that kind of an environment where the patient is freed of negative expectations and allowing, potentials, you can see a lot of good things happen. And stuff that, is not supposed to be curable gets better. Or, this patient had stage 4 cancer, there's no stage 5, she's on the way out. That kind of thinking. If you take that away and get the, and if the patient succeeds in removing it, then you see the stage 4 cancers, heal and come back. So, that's why I think it's just so important to understand what holism is, what healing, and healing, of course, means to make whole. So you're trying to help that person heal the breach between, either them and good habits or feeling good or whatever it is that they need in order to reach their healing potential.
Like we keep asking, well, why is this? Well, why is that? Well, why is
yeah.
this? Until we
yeah.
get to the root of
yes.
sort of what makes the
yes. But
person.
I also like to sit in mystery, too. I do ask all the whys, and you try to figure everything out as best you can. And, I'm always trying to understand the patient as a human being and what his or her life is like and how this illness came about in that life and what would it mean to become whole again for that person. But
So, and sometimes it takes a lot of work to do that. It takes a lot of work on the part of the patient to...
Yes. Yeah, I do much better with the ones who are ready to take responsibility, to shrug off all the negatives and give it a try.
Is that because they're kind of still in that science paradigm that I could take a pill and it's magically going to change all these things in my life that have patterns and experiences and whatnot.
Right, that's our culture. We ingrain that into people, unfortunately, and you never know what you're going to be working with when a patient comes in the door and what their expectations and their limitations are and so forth. But I you learn to really enjoy being in the mystery, and you can't control everything, but you can try to harmonize that patient and yourself and with healing and see where it can go. So it, being a doctor is a beautiful experience, in that way.
What's the vital force? And let's talk about the six principles of naturopathic medicine in the last few minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the vital force for a second, because that is also a concept that goes back to Newton's day. So that Newton demonstrated that objects at rest tend to stay at rest unless a force acts on them. That's his laws of inertia. So then people say, well, what about living beings? They don't stay at rest. They don't need an external force. They have some sort of internal drive that activates and motivates them. And so the original vital force was, well, maybe there's a living force that's acting on, you know, what people in science and unfortunately biology still consider to be inert matter. And so that vital force actually was born there. Now, it had there's quite a history with it, and it was a controversial idea, you know, right from the very beginning. And we use it, you know, as naturopaths to say that, you know, that there is this organizing, activating principle, and, you know, and it gives us a great basis for, you know, setting up a lifestyle and a way of healing where you're basically working along with what your body wants to have happen.
Yeah.
Which is for you to eat good food, you not to be, you know, it's all you. The body doesn't have a problem. It's perfect. It has an amazing intelligence that works through it that is way beyond our comprehension. We'll never understand it. And so, you know, we call that the vital force. You don't have to use those terms, but honoring the wisdom of the body and recognizing that you are its problem and getting the you, you know, that has emotional needs and tension and likes ice cream and, you know, all these other things that cause the body problems, you know, getting that out of the way and then just letting the intelligence run it, and the intelligence can just take care of it. You know, and that's the whole thing about cleansing, you know, get the impediment out of the way so that the body can do what it wants to do. And if anybody who's ever done cleansing, your body loves it. And it gets right into it. As soon as you start to take the junk out of your diet and keep it really clean and simple, if you do things properly, your body goes right to work. You know, you can just tell. It's cleaning itself out. Pardon me?
What about prevention? You know, the old saying, it's the foolish man who waits to dig a well when he is already dying of thirst. That's another big principle.
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, you know, if you stick to experience, you have wisdom. You know, it's simple, obvious wisdom. So, you know, prevention is, again, getting you out of the body's way, recognizing that the body is going to run itself in an amazing way. You know, I look at cellular processes or cells under the microscope, you know, you get those, you know, the old film strips even when I was a kid. Amazing what's happening in there. You know, the idea of it being a machine would never occur to you just looking at it. Just honoring the wisdom there. And, you know, so if you do that, that is prevention, because the intelligence doesn't make mistakes. It's not the body's fault when arthritis and cancer and diabetes and so forth set in. You know, we know from Weston Price's work out in the jungles, you know, 100 years ago, those things don't happen in nature. They only happen when you violate the laws, as we were alluding to earlier.
Treat the underlying cause. Another principle.
Yeah, which is always the person. Yeah, that's right. It's not a it's not that there's not a mechanism that went awry. You know, the person's living in a way that their body can no longer hold it together. Body tries very hard. You know, I love human body. It's an amazing. You can't call it even a thing. It's not an object. It's a process. But the wisdom that makes that process go is absolute. And
sometimes, you know, illness and symptoms are wisdoms, or is actually the wisdom of the
course,
body.
We
right?
have that. Yeah, that understanding is very useful in dealing with acute disease. You know, our culture just takes it as obvious fact that all illness is bad. And if you could have a vaccine for every illness there is, that would be just a wonderful thing. You know, what our forefathers understood was the body intentionally gets ill sometimes in an acute disease in order to help that. That's one of its methods for correcting a problem. You know, I remember a doctor saying many years ago that a fever is the body's forest fire. You know, it cleans out the deadwood.
Wow.
And, you know, the rash in measles, that's old proteins being cooked and put out onto the surface to be gotten rid of. They're toxic. So, and you know, if you're going along with that, the problem with measles, always happened with the kids who couldn't develop the rash. And our forefathers recognized that, and they used the mustard plasters and so forth to bring the rash out. When kids have measles, of course, Anthroposophy is where I'm drawing this from, a great source of wisdom as well. They looked at that as a developmental step, that the child was better off after having had the measles, that it was helpful for the child's body to develop to get rid of the last vestiges of the mother's protein so that kid could individuate. And our philosophies are just so one-sided and so inch deep. You know, we don't understand that that illness could have a beneficial role, and that illness is the body's, acute illness, colds and flus, gets you off your feet. You know, most of us drive ourselves like dogs. we won't take a break unless the body, this is Chinese medicine. You say we're so young, young activity, action, going, doing. Eventually, you're going to become very yin to balance that out by being flat on your back after you had a stroke or whatever it is that gets you. So,
thank you so much for this great discussion.
Yeah, my pleasure, Dr. Z.
What's your website so folks can get in contact with you?
It's www.elementalmed, ElementalMed, as in New Hampshire, .com. So
ElementalMed, NH, New Hampshire.com.
Yeah.
Dr. George Sevastio, pleasure to have you on, and we'll have you on again to talk about Ayurveda and a whole other wealth of great topics.
All right. The pleasure was all mine, Dr. Z. Yeah, I'd be happy to. And anytime you want some help down at UB, I'd love to come down and teach and talk again. So.
Thank you.
All right, Dr. Z.
And that does it for another edition. Take care, everyone. Stay healthy.